deepest meteorology program in the country, I think I read. Hopefully that's still correct. And he is a fellow with the American Meteorological Society, so we'll let him talk first.
Uh-oh, I'm nervous because I wasn't planning to talk first. So I'll say a little bit about myself. I came to University of Oklahoma about 5 years ago. I came here from the UN system in Geneva. I was the chief of World Weather Research Program in Thorpex in the UN, which is it was interesting moving here. It still is interesting. My research is really broad, and I know there's people that don't care about parts of this probably in the room because I do have an NSF grant and was involved in a major project in Antarctica looking out weather and climate modeling over the continent and surrounding sea ice called Concordiasi with the French. Also, another area that I tend to work in is actually the area of global numerical weather prediction. I submitted a review article last night on global NWP, and the research I'm doing now with the European Center with a graduate student, Sam Lillo, actually looks at why you get forecast failures over Europe, and one mode of forecast failures is actually convection over North America. And you amplify wave patterns, trigger wave patterns, and you actually turn the switch on things like the NAO. So, and then related to that too, related to that also is work on convection. I have working with two grad students actually on tornadoes, and I won't answer questions on this. One of the work is actually submitted, going to be submitted soon, and it looks at the link between El Nino, La Nino, and tornadoes over North America with a recent PhD graduate, Ashton Robinson Cook, who works in SPC now. And the other is an interesting project of we know that tornadoes can be very sensitive to small changes in winds and stability down low. So a student, Larissa Reams, is actually looking at land use, urban land use patterns, and trying to see if it changes conditions to make tornadoes more frequently. And that work's not so far along, so it's kind of intriguing, but I won't answer questions on that, which is terrible to say to a bunch of journalists. I feel like I'm trying to be Speaker of the House. And So you know, you can see this. It's a small group, and I didn't want to break the rules in slides, but this is actually precipitation over America. And one thing you can see is this a breathing of the planet. So, you know, you're getting convection during the afternoon over Florida, over the mountains, and then you get this movement of convection, packets of convection across the plains. So you get precipitation over the plains at night. And a couple interesting things about that is, and that's what I'll be talking mostly about today, is that there's if you look at the skill of numerical weather prediction models, they almost have no skill. In fact, the Canadian forecast model said there's no skill in predicting this convective systems over the plains at night, where and when they'll occur. The situation's the same in climate models. So you're talking about the main precipitation systems over the plains at night, very poorly represented in models. And it's also interesting because it's very hard to, there's a lot of scientific debate actually as to why convection persists over the plains at night. You know, convection usually works. You heat up the boundary layer, you get storms going. You know, we see that over Florida, over the mountains. But over the plains, they tend to die off at night. So what happened is the community got together, the academic community, also NOAA, research institutions, and we put together a project that happened this past summer called PECAN. I'm from New Jersey, so don't take the pronunciation from me. And PECAN brought together 110 instruments from 17 different institutions. So it was amazingly large. There was over 350 participants, over 130 students from 28 universities, 11 research labs. There was $13.5 million of funding from the National Science Foundation, NOAA, NASA, Department of Energy. The bulk of that was from the National Science Foundation. We plan to have 27 IOPs, intensive observing periods, and we wound up having 31. And that wasn't enough for people in the 45 days. We actually had 13 additional unidentified field operations, UFOs. We had 13 of those. So we wound up having 44 different operations in 45 days. And so Bacan is what I've been working on. And it's interesting. I think that so the challenges for scientists and journalists that I'll end with is really, you know, getting the mystery of some of this stuff. You have convection that, you know, it's well known for a century probably, maybe from the settlers, that maybe before that, or certainly before that, convection starts over the mountains and there's loose packets of convection that persist over the plains at night. Sometimes even convection initiates at night, but we don't know why. The models are really poor on this, both weather and climate models, getting this this right. And this is in an age where our numerical weather prediction skill is improving about a day per decade. So we're having this march forward in skill, but nocturnal convection still stinks, you know, in terms of predicting it. So, you know, I mean, to capture some of, or the scientists and journalists to capture really some of the discovery of things that, you know, seem very calm and plain and understood around us. And journalists usually do pretty well on that. And for my own self, some things are really easy to explain, but this nocturnal convection actually tends to, I believe, persist because of waves that occur and because of stable layers that aren't heated, like, you know, during the day. And so these stable layers and waves and certain wave structures and interacting with a low-level jet keeps these things going. I've never been able to explain bores, undular bores, and wave ducts and leaky waves to journalists, so that's my shortcoming. But so, you know, we have a challenge, I think, both to make the mundane aspects of weather seem as interesting as they are, and then really explain what is really very complicated dynamics for nocturnal systems. So that's all I have. I probably went a little bit longer than I planned. Sorry.
It's approximate. And if you're saying it from the southeast where I'm from, it would be pecan.
Plains elevated convection at night.
Great. So next we have Renee McPherson, who is the co-director of the South Central Climate Science Center and an associate professor of geography and environmental sustainability at the University of Oklahoma, as well as an adjunct associate professor of meteorology. And she is also a former state climatologist of Oklahoma.
Thank you. Good morning. Get some smiling faces this morning on a Saturday morning. Excellent. So I've been here a little bit longer in the Norman area than Dave. I came down in 1987, and I stayed. Actually, I came originally from Wisconsin, and my intent was to go back, and I married an Oklahoman who's also a meteorologist, and the meteorology community here is so dynamic that once you come here, you cannot leave. So I don't know that we can call it the black hole of weather, because it's a positive, yeah. So anyway, so for about 22 years of my career, I worked to help build the Oklahoma Mesonet. The Oklahoma Mesonet is a currently 120 station weather and climate monitoring network in Oklahoma, which measures everything from your traditional atmospheric measurements, temperature and precipitation and air pressure, to some non-traditional elements, so soil moisture and solar radiation and soil temperature. And we measure this on a five-minute basis at least one station in every county of the state. And these data have been available now for 20 years. And so it started out maybe as a weather network, and it's transitioning into a climate length network. So there's a lot of things that I've learned and my colleagues have learned using data from the Oklahoma Mesonet, and I'm happy to talk about some of those later. Some of the things that we also do with the Oklahoma Mesonet that I help build are education and outreach programs. And these are programs that get communities involved in using weather and climate data. So just one example of that is that we have programs that have taught emergency managers and public safety officials on how to use weather and climate data, as well as K through 12 teachers. And we have a small town up in north central Oklahoma called Enid. And in Enid, Oklahoma, there's a sixth grade class there that partnered with their local emergency manager. This partnership started about 15 years ago. And at that time, the emergency manager was a volunteer. And he had a full-time job at a shoe store, which did not have internet at that time during the day. And so for him to keep track of the weather, it was very difficult. Well, he partnered with the sixth grade class. And during the day, the sixth grade class would keep an eye on the weather. They had a fax machine at the shoe store, and they would fax them maps and draw where the dry line was during the day so he could keep track of the weather. And when storms began to form, then he gave them a pager. They were the deputy emergency managers, and they would page him that storms would be forming. And this was just a result of putting in a scientific network in a way that would allow communities and real people to use that. Over the years, I've also worked in the area of applied climatology. So this is one of those applications. But another example is I worked with the public relations director of the Oklahoma Association for Electric Cooperatives. His name is Sid Speary. And we in Oklahoma, for the last a little over a decade, had some very disastrous ice storms. And they came upon us in a way where we didn't have that for the several decades before. Electrical utility industry was struggling with how to deal with these ice storms, these new, very devastating events for them. And he wanted to develop some sort of damage index. And so he's now, he worked with us and the Oklahoma MesoNet data, and then we got him to partner with the National Weather Service, which was producing forecasts, and now has developed an ice damage product that is being used nationally. And most recently, I've moved into working with the USGS and the South Central Climate Science Center. So these centers were set up just a few years ago. They're relatively new. And we look across the board at how climate variability and climate change affect natural resource management, affect cultural resource management in tribes. And so I'm happy to go anywhere in the discussion from smaller scale to longer scale. So,
great. Thank you, Renee. And finally, we have Greg Carbon, who is the Warning Coordination Meteorologist for the Storm Prediction Center of the National Weather Service here in Norman. He has worked on projects like the Hazardous Weather Testbed, which he can talk about, and he does an annual year-in-review of big weather events around the country that, for the National Weather Association. He's been doing it since 2004, and we'll be doing it this coming week.
I should be doing it now. I mean, working on it. Good morning. And I think most everyone was in the workshop the other day, so you heard how important maps are, right? You know? We did maps, and I sensed a little angst during that talk. But Renee gets the length award. I came in 1996 to Norman. I grew up in the East. I was working actually with the National Weather Service in Wilmington, North Carolina, and an opportunity came up here in Norman that I decided to go for. And I convinced my wife that, you know, it's really not that bad. I'd been out here the year earlier at radar school, where they have the Doppler radar training down near where the National Weather Center is now. And so I had spent about a month here the year before and kind of knew what the community was like. And I said, you know, I think you'll like it. It'll be okay. And so Two cars, two cats, two kids from I-40. We headed out, got here June of 1996 on a 106-degree day. And my wife's quote is famous, "You've brought us to hell." It's famous at work, hopefully not nationally. So no, don't do that. But we have lived here ever since, and it is a wonderful place to be as a meteorologist. We raised our two kids. The schools here are great. Both kids ended up being musicians. I don't know how that ended up. Something in the water, maybe. And the meteorology is ongoing and ever-changing and fascinating, and it is an extremely difficult place to look elsewhere, because once you look at a place like Boulder or you look at a place like Washington, these other locations in the country that offer, you know, a dense network of meteorologists, perhaps similar to here, you cannot find the same topics, the same focus as you have here with short-term severe weather. It's a really wonderful time to be alive as a meteorologist, too, because the changes are incredible. And in the 25 years I've been in operational meteorology, the things that I've seen come to pass were clearly dreams not so long ago. So, and when I was listening to Dave talk about all the work he's been involved in, the challenge is scale. It's a scale problem, both spatially and temporally for us. And it's from years, on a temporal scale, it's years, months, days, hours, and minutes. And on the spatial scale, it's global, hemispheric, continental, regional, and our own backyard. And it's the point is that unlike politics, all weather is not local, but that local weather can actually have quite an impact globally. But we don't know all the details. In fact, they're very complicated details as to how that interaction occurs across scales and across time. And that's one of the fascinating things I find in meteorology, is trying to understand that interaction across time and scale. I've become increasingly interested in the climate connection to weather and severe weather, and probably because that has more questions than a lot of other things. Severe weather is not easily understood with respect to climate scale dynamics. It's small scale, ephemeral, especially with respect to tornadoes. And the connection between the larger scale climate signal and the severe storms is not a very easy one to make. Andrea mentioned the year in review talk that I've been doing for the last almost 15 years for the NWA and others. It's my shtick. I get to go to the annual meeting and I get a half hour to give the talk, which isn't enough time. It's usually designed to be about 45 minutes. And I titled it My Meteorological Memory, so nobody can give me any heat. These are my ideas, my memories from the year. And if your event doesn't make it, I'm sorry. And I don't rank the events. I go chronologically through the year. And I consider myself an equal opportunity meteorologist. Even though I'm here in Norman, Oklahoma, I'm interested in all types of weather, tropical, flooding, winter, heat, drought, wildfires, and the like. So this year's talk, it has occurred to me after doing this for over a decade, presents some of the more anomalous and remarkable events that I've experienced. And it's a relatively short time span of experience. That includes the winter weather in New England and the Boston snowfall earlier in the year. It includes the lack of severe weather for the early part of the year. We issued only 13 watches for the first 3 months of the year, a number that has never been that low. The average is up around, I think, 50 or 80. I don't have the figure in front of me. When you look at the chance of getting through the end of March with around 10 to 15 watches, knowing what we know about the record, which goes back to 1970, and the probability of a severe weather watch on any day, that low number is extremely rare. And so that was something that stood out. The rains we had here in April and May, absolutely stunning. 45, 46 inches of rain in 2 months at my house, just east of here. Incredible and hard to put in context when you know, the record's a little over 100 years old, and there's nothing like that in the record. And if you run simulations on it, you can get to that, but maybe once every 1,000, 5,000 years in the current record in a static climate, and we know that's obviously not the case. And then the drought, the long-term drought, the blob in the sea surface temperatures off in the eastern Pacific, highly anomalous, not really in the observed record. and you know, the South Carolina event the other day. So there are a number of things that have happened just this year that present extremes in our understanding of what the atmosphere is capable of doing. And the big question is, you know, are they occurring more often? And we don't know the answer to that. So leave it there.
Great. All right, we'll take questions now. So you guys probably know by now, SEJ members and non-member journalists go first. If you have a blue tag, make sure to identify yourself and your affiliation.
Kathy Kowalski, freelance science news for students, Midwest Energy News. When you talk about all the different kinds of extreme events, and you said we don't know yet, are they occurring more often? How close are we to attribution of particular events? I mean, how much can we say seems to be related to climate change? Or I guess, where are we in being able to get beyond, you can expect events like this more often, to, you know, this storm happened because it was made X times more likely.
Oh,
that's right.
I think the main thing is it's a very active research area, especially for severe weather. We know that ENSO's connected, ENSO variations are connected to storm frequency over North America. We know changes in stability and land use all can play a role, but I think it's an active open area of research. I was a co-author on a paper with Kevin Trenberth quite a while ago that suggested that extremes looked like precipitation extremes were increasing, but it was really difficult to determine whether that was true or not within the uncertainty of radar and precip measurements and population growth. So there is hints that extremes may be increasing, but I think it's still a very open question. Happy to say that's my most cited paper.
Do you guys have anything to add? Or?
So from my perspective, I haven't been involved in the attribution research, and part of the reason for that is purposeful. I find, so my concern is that attribution research is focused on blaming. I'm pointing a finger at someone or something, and in a litigious society, that can be a very dangerous thing. What I'd like to see our focus is on how do we adapt and become a more resilient society, community, families, individuals for the future that we're going to have. So it's clear that climate change will be changing. And is changing our extremes, but to determine the percent of that that's due to natural causes or to human causes, I don't find gets us any farther down the road when it comes to creating more resilient society. So
I'll pick up on the resiliency part and the blame part a little bit with respect to tornado events. Without getting technical, we can look at what we've done in society with respect to development. And sprawl is a direct problem with respect to damage from tornado events. Tornado events are pretty small scale. They don't affect a very large area. But if we continue to develop the way we do and we spread across the landscape, we're essentially making ourselves a larger target for these events. So, you know, that's not really attribution, but I think it's something that we need to consider, not just for severe weather, but other forms, flooding. You know, don't build in the floodplains. Don't keep putting people back on the coast. These are things that we can do without even having to make attribution to events and just look at the past.
Just wanted to say, as a scientist, attribution is a wonderful thing to look at. I mean, we have to have scientific intellectual curiosity here, but I did want to say that the Trenberth paper really was just saying that it looks like extremes are increasing. We didn't really we don't have the data to argue attribution. And I also wanted to follow up with what Greg said, that a lot of the, if you look at the increase in, exponential increase in, say, property damage worldwide from hydrometeorological events, it's climbing dramatically, and really that, a lot of that is just the exponential population growth and the concentration of wealth. So, you know, it's an interesting societal meteorological climate type problem.
So it sounds like it was an extraordinary year, and some of these things may well be just disconnected and no connection to each other, but do we have any idea of whether there were any connections to some of these things? And
the events, you mean, one from one to the next? Well, yeah, I mean, you can look at what we've seen over the last year or two is this large scale pattern that features a ridge of high pressure in the western portion of North America, northwest flow in the mean across the central United States, and then troughing and storminess and cold air that flows across the Great Lakes into New England. That's been sort of a quasi-stationary pattern in place. Why? Well, maybe Dave can talk to that a little bit, why patterns set up that way. One interesting aspect of that was the blob, that the above normal temperatures in the eastern Pacific, there's a feedback associated with that warm air, and that's to build that ridge of high pressure across western North America and help maintain that pattern. There's hints, I think, recently that some of those sea surface temperatures are starting to fall, but that we don't know what influence that will have, other than to have a feedback and establish this quasi-stationary pattern that tends to support some of the events that we've seen. And then with the onset of El Nino, I think there was a contribution there, perhaps in the spring, to the heavy rain. So there are a number of factors that play into and connect some of these events.
Possibly a sign that some of the heat that has been accumulating in the ocean was actually starting to make its way out in increase in the amount of heat that's coming out of the oceans, or is that just wild speculation?
I'm not an expert on the blob, but when you do get these ridges set up and light winds and a lot of clear air incoming solar radiation, you tend to get this heating of the upper ocean, and I think it's really not the deep transport of heat from below, but it's more the heating of the upper ocean. I wanted to just follow up with a point that Greg made about in his comments about what an exciting time it is to be an atmospheric scientist and to be a forecaster. And really, for the first time in our careers, we now have global models that can resolve convection locally. So looking at some of these problems of with storms over or extremes over the North America and the impact of ENSO or the warm blob, looking at the effects of convection on over North America on turning the switch on the North Atlantic Oscillation. This is the first time in our lives we've actually been set up to work on this issues at the weather-climate interface. And the National Science Foundation now is finally getting a program manager actually looking at this area. And I can remember 10 years ago when we were doing global NWP project, we'd have long philosophical discussions with program managers on there. Should we even be bringing the weather climate people together? And now, 12 years later from that conversation, they're finally doing it. But it's a really exciting time. And for the first time, maybe we can look at some of these attribution issues.
I'm Karen Schaefer. I'm a freelance public radio journalist based in Northern Ohio. And I cover Lake Erie a lot. Well, you may have heard we've had a little problem with algae there. And what's interesting to me is that we have NOAA and a whole slew of institutions, professors, agencies, including NASA Glenn Research Center, working on trying to predict when we're going to get a bad algae bloom in Lake Erie. What we don't have are weather scientists working on how to predict, or maybe it's not possible, when we're going to have really heavy rainfalls in the spring, which are the driving factor or a driving factor in producing these blooms. Are we any closer to being able to do that kind of prediction when it comes to really local weather patterns?
We're a lot closer. And the dynamics that occur to generate heavy rain are primarily associated with thunderstorms. And so the work that's been done here in Oklahoma and in modeling convection, deep convection, and the understanding of how that is sustained and fueled is modeled to some extent relatively well, and it's modeled even better if you have a whole slew of models, and if you run them at very high resolution and you look and see whether they're in agreement or disagreement. The ensemble approach to prediction has made tremendous strides in our ability to hopefully anticipate some of the more extreme events. And so we use ensemble prediction on a very fine scale, about 2 to 4 kilometer resolution across the continental United States. And while some events are not well predicted by the ensemble, others are remarkably well predicted. And the real challenge is trying to figure out, as a forecaster, is this a day that I'm going to buy into this prediction and get the word out, or is this a day that I'm going to, you know, I don't think I'm going to put faith into this particular solution, or the models have a lot of different solutions. But it is small scale, and up in Lake Erie, one of the challenges is the boundary of the lakes, the lake-land interface, and sea breezes and lake breezes, and how those influence the evolution of storms and the dynamic of the wind field associated with those boundaries. So it is definitely a local issue there, but the modeling has gotten better, and there will be, you know. And then on a larger scale, when you back out, the ability to say perhaps that you're going into a wet pattern for the spring or a dry pattern will help as well.
I think one of the big challenges is when we look at this on a climate basis, so a lot of the questions that people will have is, how often will these algae blooms now occur? Will they occur more often 10, 20, 50 years from now? And I think our biggest challenge on that is that when you run a weather model, you just are running it out to maybe 14 days. And the computational resources that are needed at that very high resolution and hopefully with an ensemble of models is immensely larger than when you're looking at how might these events change in the future.
Yeah, two things to add. I think there's hope for that particular problem. One, it's been touched on already by my two colleagues up here, is ensemble prediction. And beyond the weather timescale, we don't really do it. I mean, they sort of combine different climate models, but it's not the same setup to, you know, vary the initial conditions, vary the uncertainty and all the physics and come up with an ensemble prediction. And my own bias is that's what you need for a seasonal prediction. There's a really good example of that, the barbecue summer in the UK several years ago. The UK seasonal prediction team came out and said, it's gonna be a beautiful summer in the UK. It's the barbecue summer. So literally they've shown that people canceled their trips in the south of France and going to Spain and Portugal and stayed in the UK, and it wasn't the warm barbecue summer. And what happened, there was one event, I think it was in the Pacific, and this big cyclogenesis event, it caused a Rossby wave to go out, and there was Rossby wave breaking over the UK, and you know, one event changed that seasonal prediction, one strong cyclogenesis, and you know, you really need ensemble prediction to get that the chance of the cyclogenesis in the right, the formation of a strong cyclone in the right place in the right time in the Pacific. So I think we're almost waiting on high resolution and true ensemble prediction for seasonal forecasting. And the other thing is something Environment Canada is doing, where they're actually taking the weather models, they're linking it to hydrological models, to runoff, and then they model all the way down to the fisheries. So they'll actually, you know, rope off areas for fishing, commercial fishing, based on forecast models that they believe have a lot of skill. It tends to be on the shorter time scale. And they actually also take human dynamics modeling and have, you know, can watch people driving around and trying to avoid the floods, and they try to get an idea of where people will get hung up and try to cross roads. So there is this, I think, you know, seasonal prediction. Hopefully in my lifetime, I'll live that long, that, you know, we really have the computing capability to do high resolution ensembles out to 28 days, 45 days. And then the other is this really cross-discipline modeling from weather, hydro, fisheries, algae, human dynamics, which some countries are starting to do. Environment Canada does this quasi-operationally for parts of the Great Lakes. So that stuff's way cool, but it's on the horizon.
Seth Borenstein, Associated Press. Forgive me, I came in late, so if you touch this, just feel free to ignore. But you did talk about attribution and an earlier Trenberth paper you did with Trenberth. Lately, Kevin has been talking about the whole question of individual events and attribution being just the wrong question and just saying everything has changed, so we shouldn't be worrying about attribution of individual events. Everything has a climate change connection. And I'm wondering what you, the three of you, feel about that. And a second question you probably have already touched on, but the concept from Jennifer Francis and Steve Vavras on the Arctic blocking and the lazy jet stream.
The attribution is an interesting one that I'll turn back around again and say that in light of recent events and we should be learning how to build resiliency and it seems like we're not very good learners in a lot of cases, and we keep putting people back in harm's way in places that get hit again and again. But that's a tough one to do for tornadoes. There was a study, I was on a study panel for the city of Moore a couple of months ago. They were looking to get some funding for looking at how to build better. And I said, it would be great to put the entire city of Moore underground. And then, you'd have a nice prairie between here and the airport in Oklahoma City. And no, that's never going to happen. So that's a huge challenge. How do we build better and out of harm's way? And then how do you convince people to put the resources into those endeavors when they can turn around, like in the case of South Carolina, although I hear it's raining heavy again this weekend in South Carolina, they're not going to get 25 inches of rain. And they tell you, well, if it's a once in a thousand year event, why should I bother? How do we convince them that, that's not the way to think of the problem. Think of the problem in terms of vulnerability and making choices and using some resources now so that it's not as expensive to recover. The amplitude question is an interesting one. Jennifer Francis came out with the initial work, there was pushback by the meteorology community as far as that signal in the reanalysis information. It is very interesting from a severe weather perspective that anecdotally I can tell you that it seems recent years, ever since 2011, there has been this pattern across North America that's been relatively lame as far as active severe weather, active jet stream. Every once in a while you'll break that pattern and you'll have a pretty significant event. But it does appear as if there's been this bit of a slackening. Now, whether that's related to Jennifer Francis's work, I've always been a little bit in doubt about some of that, how global or Arctic ice concentration reaches a minimum in September, October, and how that can have impacts that last months on end, or whether we're into something that we haven't seen before. So maybe Dave knows more about that, or I'll pass it down.
So I do think that's a very active area of research. I think there's more connection between the Arctic region and our mid-latitudes than we understand right now. In the School of Meteorology, Stephen Cavallo is one of our relatively new professors who has a very strong interest in seeing how the Arctic and the mid-latitudes are connected in terms of generation of cyclones. So I think that's going to be one of these areas of research that will continue to be a hot topic for a while. With regard to attribution, I had mentioned earlier that I'm not personally a big fan. Our society is very litigious, and so attribution can be seen as just looking, for someone to blame. What I like us to focus on is how do we adapt our society to become more resilient? And one of the very interesting areas of growing research now, meteorologists and climatologists And geographers historically have all huddled in their little corners and spoken to each other and interacted. And you know, there's been calls out for a couple of decades for us to actually get out and speak with other scientists and engineers. And it hasn't happened for a while, but now there's a very large area of research that's starting to move forward, essentially called coupled human natural systems research. So coupled human natural systems admits that humans and natural systems actually work together, and the dynamics of those work in ways that we don't understand sufficiently enough now. And so this is a really interesting area when we're talking about adaptations of societies and of peoples. How do people understand the weather events or the climate events that are imposed upon them? And what of their value system or their interactions through social media help them to change and make new decisions based on that? And without knowing those dynamics, we as physical scientists really have no ability to help society make those changes. And so this is a huge growing area of research. Most of my colleagues, I'm happy to say right now, are actually not meteorologists who I research with, because of this really important area that's growing.
So I did write a paper with Kevin years ago, but I haven't read his most recent one, so I won't comment. I did want to say something about the polar regions. Before I came here, I was involved in the leadership of a project called Thorpex. Thorpex had 8 or 10 programs under the International Polar Year in the Arctic and one in the Antarctic. And these polar regions are fascinating. You know, there's errors in the initial conditions and the errors in models, numerical models, tend to be very large over the poles. I think in part this is because of a big emphasis on mid-latitudes and tropics in our research. So these errors in initial conditions and forecasts are quite large there. We know that as the sea ice melts and contracts, we'll change the temperature gradient, what we call the baryclinicity in the surface in that region. So we get one change because of that. We also get a change in the sea ice in a feature called a tropospheric polar vortice, which is actually something right at the tropopause lower stratosphere. Sea ice, they like to live when there's sea ice, which is sort of the opposite of regular storms, where you think of this flux of water vapor from warm oceans. So you do get this tropospheric polar vortice issue that they tend to like sea ice, and they can be very long-lived. Last many, many weeks or more. Stephen Cavallo here is, Renee mentioned, is Stephen's one of the experts in this area. And it's a really fascinating area of research just for the polar issues of the errors being so large. But also we know that for the storm track in mid-latitudes, the two biggest sources of disturbances in Rossby waves and fronts and highs and lows that move are actually sources coming from the upper troposphere in the tropics and the, you know, the tropopause lower stratosphere in polar regions. That's kind of the energy sources. And so changes in the poles are really important. It's an area where we don't do very well. And then there's this, you know, this idea, if we can actually get these initial perturbations, these initial little, you know, things going on in the poles better or tropics better, we're going to push our inherent predictive skill further into to mid-latitudes further and further. So, yeah, it's a great area, and it's a great question. I haven't read Kevin's paper, and I'll stay away from attribution from Kevin.
Hi, I'm Bob Hinson, Weather Underground. So, El Nino. we have one of the strongest on record, obviously, in place and setting up for the winter, and you would expect from precedent that you would get certain impacts, pretty predictable impacts around the country, right? And the message we get is that the stronger the El Nino, the more reliable many of these impacts are. But of course, it becomes a very small data set that's based on as they become stronger. So I'm wondering how queasy each of you are in terms of what is being said about this winter, and especially in the context of the Jennifer Francis Beveris hypothesis. And could that throw a monkey wrench into this El Nino? And if so, what are you all going to tell people?
I'm very queasy. I think we're in an area of, like you say, these are nonlinear, systems. So just because it looks like it did, one or two times before, doesn't mean you can say that X equals Y, that you're going to have some kind of impact, across some part of the... And we know that the connections are actually stronger in some areas of the country or some parts of the globe than others. El Nino's long been thought to support wintertime tornado events and severe weather along the Gulf Coast in Florida. And during the last El Nino event, the National Weather Service offices in Florida reached out to the Storm Prediction Center, and they said, we want to do an outreach effort, and we want you to be on notice that if we have severe storm potential, especially at night, given the past El Nino events, they had some deadly tornadoes there in El Ninos in the past in February. We want to get out ahead of that. And so we agreed to lower the threshold a little bit and to get out and get the message out in public statements if we thought that there was a probability, even a very low probability, of tornadoes, especially nighttime tornadoes over the Florida Peninsula. Well, that El Nino unfolded, and it was fascinating to watch. There were numerous opportunities during that winter for severe storms, and in fact, there were thunderstorms that crossed on numerous occasions. There was convection in Florida, which isn't unusual, but there were very few severe weather events, so very few tornado events, and that just goes to show you the slight changes in those small-scale conditions that we don't have any way of really anticipating too far in advance. So there's the outreach was good, and we still have it in place for this year, and actually we're revamping that again and looking at putting public weather outlooks out for nighttime tornado events in the south if it indeed manifests itself. I did want to go back real quick to Renee's comment about working with across boundaries and across disciplines. My favorite deceased scientist is Ed Lorenz, but my favorite living scientist is E.O. Wilson, and he wrote an excellent book called Consilience, 10 decades or so ago, that talks about using the advances, the amazing advances that we've made using the scientific method and applying that to societal issues and societal problems. And there are hints of that, but he's eloquent, and he's amazing as a scientist and a speaker for sharing science with people and trying to make the best of what we've got.
So I would say that if I were in California, I would still be focused on ensuring that there's going to be enough water resources that if the rain that they're hoping for from this large El Nino event doesn't occur, that they're going to still go on. That said, I would also now, which they probably haven't been focused on in the past couple of years, I would also be prepared for floods. The drought has done significant damage to the ecosystems there. And if in the case this El Nino does, follow some of the probabilities of higher rainfall, they do need to be prepared for these types of flooding events, and especially in their public safety offices need to be highly prepared to make sure that traffic is not flowing on roads that are known to flood. So I think that this is one area where decision makers need to be prepared for the worst, and the worst includes, unfortunately for that region, both continued drought and significant floods.
I'm not uncomfortable at all because I don't have to make seasonal predictions. I'm just a professor who likes to research how things work. But it is really interesting because it is, this very strong El Nino coupled with the the warm blob, and also my earlier statement that I think is true, that you know, the strong events, convective storms, cyclogenesis, you know, can flip the switch on large-scale patterns. So, you know, unless you have a high-resolution ensemble, you're just sort of going on some statistical hope, and or you know, models that are, you know, waiting for the next generation. I don't mean to sound too cynical, but being in a regime where we really haven't seen before, or at least this, you know, very strong warm blob and a very strong El Nino, I'm really happy, just delighted that I'm not having to make any seasonal predictions.
One quick comment on that. I saw a map out this morning on Twitter. I won't name the source, but it was a single look at the upcoming winter, just a single map showing the anomaly for the upcoming winter, and it that kind of drives me nuts, because it's like, well, you know, what's the variability in that output? And I know we don't have a lot, but it was from the climate forecast system model, which does have a number of different members in its ensemble. So posting a single map, a deterministic view of what the season is supposed to be, is a very misleading piece of information, in my opinion. Yeah.
But still, I you know, we have ensembles, but I think we're really waiting for real seasonal ensembles that capture the uncertainty in the models and the initial conditions and the physics, the way global NWP models work.
Craig Miller with KQED in San Francisco. I have to beat the attribution horse one more time here. That we're looking at events not just Sandy, but Irene, that where there was flooding in Vermont from a hurricane, it almost seemed like the new metric for severity of a hurricane should be rain, not wind. And then South Carolina and the rains that you alluded to here before. Is there at least an emerging consensus with the extreme precipitation that, yes, there's a trend here, and, yes, it has warming fingerprints all over it?
So I would say that that's certainly the case, that scientists know that our climate is changing. We know the physical processes that are associated with those changes, and we understand the results from increased warming, which includes increased more moisture. Certainly the rains that we've seen in Oklahoma, that we've measured with our Oklahoma Mesonet. We've had several rain events here in the state that have been 500-year rainfall events. We've seen numerous 100-year rainfall events in the 20 years that we've had the Mesonet. Now, can that happen just through random statistics? Yes, it can. But certainly the fingerprint of climate change on these larger scale events, these more extreme events, is, I think, is clear to most people. The concern about focusing on attribution itself is that doesn't necessarily solve the immediate problem of our cities are at risk, and our public officials need to look toward communicating across their region, not just within their various silos within governments, but across their region and across their own government, to try to determine solutions and be proactive about it rather than having solutions imposed upon them. So at some point, the insurance industry will impose some solutions on coastal construction and constructing and floodplains and those types of things. But wouldn't it be so much better if we design our cities and our communities in a way that makes sense, knowing that these events are going to be continuing to be extreme in the future?
I did a little bit of a look into, there's an atmospheric parameter called precipitable water that gives us basically, if you were to wring out the atmosphere above your head, you know, that's how much liquid would result. Precipitable water is a, you know, it's a measure of moisture in the air, and I started getting interested in this a few years ago with respect to northeast snowstorms, because they were just getting clobbered one after another, and I wanted to know, you know, even though that snow, you're only a degree away from it being rain, is there some signal there for increased moisture in the nor'easters? And I didn't find one. And I was looking this year at the precipitable water extremes with respect to the springtime events here in the plains in April and May. And I'm using for this the North American Regional Reanalysis data set, which goes back only to 1979. But it's a relatively high resolution, high quality reanalysis set to try to understand if there's any change in trends. And I wasn't finding it. I did not see what I expected to see. Yes, there was above normal values of moisture in the air for the spring, but when you look at the number of days that we see that over that record of 37 years or so, the number of days with extreme precipitable water values in the southeast United States over that period of time does not appear to have changed for April and May. And I was a bit disappointed. I thought, oh, I see something here. The other day, a colleague of mine brought in his data set of atmospheric sounding information from the United States that goes back to 1950. And he was showing me how he was looking at monthly, annual summaries of this data. And it goes back a little bit farther than 79. So we looked at precipitable water. There's a remarkable increase in precipitable water at the beginning of the record from 1950 to about 1980. And since the 80s, it's been sort of flatlined. Now, that could be a result of sensor changes in the way we measure this. But it could also be a very real signal, and one that, looking at a relatively short span of 37 years, I just did not find. But if I were to go back a little bit further, perhaps there is a trend there. But maybe it's, why is it leveled if it has leveled off? I don't know. But I thought that was kind of interesting, because I was looking for that signal to be there. But because my data was truncated in 1979, I found nothing.
One more. If we're not calling it attribution, how do you tell people the risk has gone up of these extreme events hitting your city? I mean, you alluded to, and I think you did, Renee, well, if it's only a 1,000-year event, it's gone. How do you try to say, you know, the warmer world we're living in, you can expect this much more often, X more often. If you're going to take action, you need to design for it.
So in Oklahoma, where I primarily work, you just have to bring out the historical record and say, we are not even designed for the climate variability that this state is known for. The message that is best communicated in, at least in this area of the country, has to do with the fact that most Oklahomans, most people in the Southern Great Plains are very, very weather and climate savvy. They understand the extremes that occur in this part of the world, and they do recognize that when we get 14 inches of rain in Norman, Oklahoma in May, that our drainage systems here in the city do not handle that well, and that there are even meteorologists who will say, we aren't even prepared to drive in that. We tell people turn around and don't drown, and there's a handful of my colleagues that have admitted that when it was pouring here in Norman, that they were around, you know, driving in town. So yeah. So our societies are still not prepared for the extremes that we currently have. So at least in this part of the country, if it's an audience who I know will not be receptive to the climate change message, it doesn't need to be there to still communicate that we need to get our cities more resilient. The number of FEMA declared disasters is the highest nationwide right here in Oklahoma. And we can't rely on the federal government to continue to essentially pay for disaster after disaster. Sometime that money trail will end, and so we need to be better prepared to reduce those damages.
I'm going to say something provocative that will probably get me in trouble. That, you know, when I said before about getting the journalists, getting the message of where these unknowns are, you know, for nighttime convection, the models have almost no skill. And the public debate and political debate is really about, you know, attribution and long-term climate change. But really where the science, and I think a lot of the societal needs are, really are from this inter and intra-seasonal prediction out to decadal prediction. What's the spring going to be like? And, you know, is it going to be algae blooms in the Great Lakes? Are we going to get another 45 inches of rain in 2 months in Oklahoma? Or will it be in the Carolinas? And, you know, the models are changing so we can finally look at these problems. So sometimes I get a little frustrated about where the journalistic and political debate is versus where my own personal belief of where the exciting science is in that interseasonal to decadal, the weather-climate interface, pulling in the human dynamics and the hydrology, you know, the example of predicting where people are going to drive around in a heavy rainfall event like they're doing in Canada. So there's almost really a mismatch of where the journalistic and public attention is on terms of exciting problems. And I guess the other provocative thing is that the early estimates of the change in temperature from CO2 made on the back of the envelopes are not that different than the climate model projections. So, you know, it's really this, you know, this exciting scientific area and this intersection of scientific and societal needs, I think maybe is you know, lying in another area. So I saw the AP guy left when I said that.
Yeah, he was smiling. Yeah, unrelated.
To try to address the... Oh, is that what it is? Yeah. To try to address the this issue, I think I'll tell a story. I was thinking about this in terms of, ultimately, it comes down to personal responsibility and societal responsibility. And I'll tell the story with respect to personal responsibility, because as a scientist, I know that the odds of a tornado, even here in central Oklahoma, are very low, and that I'm not going to worry about a storm shelter in my house. I don't need one of those. Until I was away, about 1,000 miles away in Minnesota in an April day, and there was a tornado that touched down in Norman, and I look at the radar, and it's headed toward my neighborhood, and my wife is home, and I'm texting like crazy, saying, you know, to get to a safe place. It doesn't look good. And the next text I get back from her is sirens, so she knows what to do. But a year ago, I put in a garage storm shelter. And it wasn't because I scientifically evaluated that risk and, you know, oh, well, the probability is 0.2% on a day in May. It was because of peace of mind. And so the odds of having the tornado move over my house are incredibly small. But if I'm away and my wife is home, I want to know that she's got a place to go. And so, you know, it's not logical. It's not to me as a scientist, but emotionally, it makes a lot of sense. So that's where maybe we need to be going with some of the debate.
So I'd agree with Dave in terms of the time scale that most decision makers are. So he was talking about the science itself, and he finds that that's the most exciting area. But the decision makers are also most focused on the seasonal to multi-year scale. You know, they have to prepare annual budgets for their communities, or they have to know what crop to put in the ground, or am I going to get two crops out this year because we're going to have a longer growing season for this particular year. And so this is one of the reasons why We have a number of the entities that are funded both nationally and locally that are considered these boundary organizations, the state climate offices in every state, the climate science centers, these NOAA regional integrated sciences and assessment programs, or the NOAA RESA programs. They're these boundary organizations that the decision makers can come to, and regardless of whether it's a question about how much rain am I going to get in South Carolina in the next couple of days, or will my community be under 2 feet of sea level rise 70 years from now, they come to the same organizations because they're a trusted organization. And I think that's one of the things that is really important to kind of communicate as journalists, is that there are these organizations that are out there that can be helping communities and that are available to answer some of these really, you know, huge economic questions when it comes to dealing with these continued extremes in weather and climate.
I'll just add something really quick, that the one-day prediction for the continental U.S. depends on conditions that extends out past the dateline and a third of way across the Atlantic. The five-day forecast, I think, gets most of the hemisphere and into the tropics. So, you know, these are, you know, they're local storms, but they're part of a global circulation, and, you know, and really, you know, there's global answers to these things, and the prediction is a global enterprise beyond, you know, hours.
All right, we have one last question before we wrap up.
I'm Christy George. I'm a journalist from Portland, Oregon, and I'm interested in the culture clashes, potential culture clashes here. If you're looking at human dynamics, in which I think is great, and you talked about time scales that people are interested in, you're dealing with, first off, you're dealing with the culture clash, I think, between weather forecasters and climate forecasters, but also pump in a few things like businesses that operate on a quarterly balance sheet and politicians who run for re-election on two-year cycles or six-year cycles. How are you going to deal with the different cultures?
We just do our science in the school, and I've never felt any political or cultural pressure on what we research.
So in the in these boundary organizations that do work directly with stakeholders and the general public, we do feel those pressures. So for example, the climate science centers are really focused primarily on longer-term climate change and the impacts over decades of climate change on ecosystems and water resources. And we aren't, when we're speaking in audiences about that, and there are people who say, but tell me what's going to happen with this El Nino event. You know, am I going to experience more flooding? Is it going to be, you know, it's supposed to be cold and wet in Oklahoma. Are we going to have ice storms this winter? This is where kind of our, we usually hire people who are broadly trained and try to keep in touch with our colleagues and other organizations, but we also partner with a lot of these other boundary organizations. So for example, in Oklahoma, specifically, we're partners with the Oklahoma Climatological Survey, and they keep much better track of kind of the daily and seasonal weather than we do at the Climate Science Center. And so a quick call to them or handing, you know, the question off to them is something that we do on a fairly regular basis. So one of the nice things about the weather and climate community is, yes, we all have kind of our personal areas of interest, but it's a fairly close-knit community. It's relatively small compared to maybe like the medical community or the law community. Most people know each other pretty well, and so we know where the expertise is to help out with that. I know we're running out of time, so I just wanted to leave just real quickly before I hand it over to Greg on one thing that provides me hope as we're looking ahead for adapting to climate change. So I'm sure that you're all very familiar with the Six Americas study that produced from the Yale Project. And so in the Six Americas study, they had nationally 63% of the people who believed that climate change was occurring. In the state of Oklahoma, so the segment of that is 57%. And we have an undergraduate student in the Climate Science Center named Benjamin Ignok. And he, for one of his projects, went to a number of the general education classes held at the University of Oklahoma. These are non-science students primarily, and they're large classes. He had 515 respondents at the beginning of the semester before any of us started teaching about climate change. In fact, I do climate change on Tuesday in my class. And 91% of the University of Oklahoma students believed that climate change was occurring. 45% of them were concerned about climate change, and 38% are cautious about climate change. My hope is that this generation that is coming through our school systems now, our universities now, and moving into the workforce are concerned enough about climate change and these extremes in weather and climate that they're actually going to do something about it, even if there are two-year cycles in the House of Representatives.
That's a climate I'm not going to predict. I guess the clash of cultures is an interesting one, and I'm going to answer it from the perspective of, as I said earlier, it's a pretty exciting time to be a meteorologist, but I imagine it's a pretty exciting time to be an environmental journalist and a science writer. There is so much going on, not just in meteorology, but in all the sciences that affect humankind. And I was asked, I did an interview for this TV news check a few months back, and they were asking about hype in the media and why so much hype. Why do we turn on the TV and everything is a disaster, or everything's out of control? And I think about that, and I wonder, with respect to weather forecasting, one of the great things is it gives us certainty, to some extent, in a way that other aspects of life do not have certainty. And so there's this aspect of science that's given us the ability to see the future. And so much of life, you can't do that. We cannot tell what tomorrow will bring in our own personal lives. But science has given us the ability and the tools to tell you what the temperature tomorrow will be or what the odds of rain will be. The key word there being odds. We need to get across that there is uncertainty, inherent uncertainty in this information, that because we're living in a dynamic and changing world and the chaos involved with that, that there will always be outcomes that were not anticipated. But we're getting better at anticipating many of the outcomes and being able to communicate those. And I think there is this interest, this human interest in being able to predict the future that weather has brought about and weather forecasting that has also resulted in hype. People are really intrigued by the ability to tell the future. And it used to be that was a shaman's responsibility. Or I said the other day I was a prophet. So I think that causes some of the dynamic and some of the excitement, and I hope you can convey that, but not with too much hype.
Just really quickly, there, I said, there's not cultural pressures, but I can think of one, and I think actually it's a strength of the National Weather Center is really the mild tension or interplay between operational prediction and research, and how we really look at things differently. And I can remember one of the tornado events. Everybody was jumping up and down in NOAA. They said, oh, you know, we predicted this ahead of time. We said, you know, rush hour would hit I-35, and we nailed it, and, you know, it's really great. And then, you know, I was watching the same event and said, look at that, all the tornadoes died when they got to the area of highest tornado probability. And then we had a director's meeting in the Weather Center, and they were going on about, you know, this, and I was ready to go on about, yeah, it's fantastic, but there's so much more to do. And I think actually that's a strength of the Weather Center, where we have operations and then mission-oriented research, research centers, and then the fundamental science done in the school.
Great. Well, thank you guys so much for coming.